just a reminder, so the first week we spoke about obligation in davening, and we saw that until the 1600s, there is no hint in any source of a gender gap in obligation to daven. In the 1600s, you get the first source that states, well, we have this sort of far-fetched way to justify that what women are doing, which is not davening, but it's clearly not a sort of ideal principled position there. And we saw other ways of dealing with the reality that don't involve denying an obligation that clearly exists in earlier sources. Last week, we jumped into the topic of obligation to daven with a minyan. Oh, maybe folks of different genders are all equally obligated to pray, but they're not all equally obligated to pray with a minyan. And we saw a couple sources from the Gemara, which for the most part were somewhere between ambiguous to leaning towards not thinking of this as an obligation, but rather as an important value, right? If you're obligated to daven, then you should daven in as good a way as possible. Davening with a minyan is, in their opinion, in my experience, but I know not everyone's experience, a better experience than davening on your own. And so that would be seem to be what's going on. We saw one Gemara, which we'll come back to today, about this idea that if you're traveling and you want to stop for the night on a roadside inn, let's say, and there's a place to daven, the Gemara said in a synagogue, well, Rashi said in a synagogue that's four meal or less in front of you, then you must keep going up to four meal. Again, this is only Rashi's interpretation. It's actually not clear what the Gemara means, and we saw that Rabbeinu Hananel interpreted it differently in a way that makes it not relevant to our topic. But if you follow Rashi's interpretation, you'd have to go up to four meal forward in order to find a place to daven in a synagogue, and up to one meal backwards. And then we saw some medievals, we saw the Rambam sort of ambiguously, but talking about that one should strive to pray with a minyan, that we saw the language of the Gemara, also in Rambam, that you're a bad neighbor if you have a synagogue to daven in your neighborhood and you don't go there to daven, but no clear language of obligation. And we concluded last week, two medieval sources, the Maharil and the Tashbet, sources number 7 and 8. And the Maharil was talking about this idea of an Eruv Tumen, this thing that allows you to walk farther on Shabbos than you would normally be allowed to walk. But you're only allowed to set an Eruv Tumen for a mitzvah purpose. And the Maharil says, davening with a minyan does not count, right? If the only reason you want to walk farther on Shabbos is to be able to go to a shul that has a minyan, that's not a good enough reason because you can daven on your own at home. And we don't find that the sages ever required any individual to pray with 10. And likewise, the Tashbetz, source number 8, said, if you're in shul and you can leave and there will still be a minyan without you, then you can leave. You want to go to the Kiddush club? I don't encourage that. I think it's bad for other reasons. But it is not a problem because you're obligated to pray with a minyan, because in fact, there is no such obligation. You can just say, look, there's a minyan without me. As long as we've got a minyan, my only obligation is part of a communal obligation that there be a minyan. As long as there is a minyan, I have no such obligation. So now we get to the Shulchan Aruch, source number 9. And this is two different siyufim, two different paragraphs of the Shulchan Aruch from the same chapter, from the same siman of Shulchan Aruch. And what does he say here? Yishtadel adam lispalel beveis haknesses im hatzibur. A person should strive to pray in a synagogue with a community, with a minyan. Okay, notice that language of striving, which we spoke about last week. That language comes from the Torah. This is not language of one is obligated. And it makes sense, right? Because how can I obligate you in something that's not fully in your control, right? Even if I go to synagogue every day, there's no guarantee that there will be a minyan there. That's dependent on me and other people. So this sounds like what we've been saying until now, the sort of communal obligation piece. But that was paragraph 9, Sif Tet. But if we keep going to paragraph 16, Ha'olech baderech v'higia le'ir, one who is traveling and arrives at a city and you want to sleep in that city. So you can already hear this is the Shulchan Aruch codifying that passage from Talmud Pesachim that we saw last week, the one that Rashi and Rabbeinu Hananel interpret differently. And as we will see, he interprets it like Rashi. If there is in front of you, within 4 miles, again, basically 4 miles, a place where people are, a place where they're davening with a group of 10, Sarvich Lelech Sham. Then you need to go there. You can't just stop in that city just because you'd rather stop now. No, you got to keep going another 4 meals in order to get to that place. Uliacharav, Sarvich Lachzor Ad Mil, Kedeliz Bel Al Basara. And if there's a place where they're davening with a minyan 1 meal behind you, which is out of your way, well, then you got to keep going. You got to go backwards 1 meal, even though it's out of your way, in order to pray with a minyan. This is exactly Rashi's interpretation of that Gemara from Sahim, that ambiguous Gemara. So the Shulchan Aruch codifies this. I will note, it's not entirely clear what this means in terms of an absolute obligation, right? The Shulchan does not say here that if I'm at home, I must pray with a minyan. All he says is if I'm traveling and I could daven if I keep going, which I have to do anyway, or even if I have to go a little bit out of my way up to one meal, I have to. It's reasonable. If I'm being fully transparent, I think it's probably likely that this implies some notion of a general obligation to pray with a minyan. But it's strange that the Shulchan Aruch doesn't state what is the more normal case, right? Which is, you're at home, you got to go to the minyan. He doesn't say that. In fact, to the contrary, he says in Sif Tes, paragraph 9, yishtadel, you should strive, right? Now, obviously, if you live in a place like where I live, where there's a synagogue on almost every block, it's not that hard to strive to daven with a minyan. And so maybe that in some sense means you're basically obligated. But we would never say a person should strive not to eat pork, right? You're obligated not to eat pork. You're not striving not to eat it. So there's a little bit of a strangeness here, even as the Shulchan Aruch seems to imply, following Rashi, some kind of obligation that to daven with a minyan, even though that obligation takes into account all the limitations on one's ability to do that, is not fully in your control. We're going to skip source number 10 for the sake of time. This is the Magen Avraham. It basically summarizes things we've already seen before, so we're not going to look at it inside. Source number 11, the Mishneh Brura, one of the most important commentaries on the first section of Shulchan Aruch, a late 19th, early 20th century commentary. And we're going to look only at a paragraph 52 here, Sif Nun Beis. So this is number 52. Says the Mishneh Brura, Vayoshev Beveso Dino Kimelech Harav Alkein Hadarbi Yishuv Toch Mil LaMakom Shiviz Palalin Basara. So what does the Mishneh Berurah say? If you're at home, well, that's like going out of your way when you're traveling for a minyan. And so since when you're traveling, you have to go backwards, out of your way, up to one meal to go daven with a minyan. Well, at home, it's also out of my way, right? I could just stay at home and watch TV, daven, of course, but watch TV. So it's out of my way to go to the synagogue. So the rule is, according to the Mishneh Berurah, right? Now, again, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't say this. The Mishneh Berurah is making a reasonable deduction from what the Shulchan Aruch said. But the reasonable deduction is, if you've got a minyan within 1 mile of you, then you're obligated to go. But then he says, Ava lo be'erev, but not at night. Ki ein zarich leilech b'layla b'derech b'shvil minyan. Right? But at night, when it's more difficult, it's hard to get, you know, you might already be in your pajamas, it's more dangerous potentially. It's just, in general, nighttime is a time that when travel is less desirable, then you actually don't have to go to a minyan. So that's already striking, right? To the extent that the Mishneh Berurah takes out of the Shulchan Aruch an obligation to daven with a minyan, first of all, it's only if you have a minyan within 1 mile of you. Again, it's not actually a mile, but it's close enough, I'm going to say that. And it doesn't go into effect at night. So if someone wants to say to me, as many people have tried, oh, the reason why women don't count in a minyan is that even though they're obligated to daven, they're not obligated to daven with a minyan. Well, what obligation do men have, right? An obligation to go up to a mile, but only during the day and not at night. Does that mean women should count in a minyan at night, but not in the daytime, right? You can already see how these kinds of arguments start to fall apart. I will conclude with this last paragraph here, which is, I think, goes back to something someone asked last week about, well, what were people actually doing? Says the Mishneh Berurah, V'zeh atzif, hu tohachas megula, la'osan ha'anashim shehem ba'ir, u'mis'at le'lech le'beis ha'knesses, l'ispalel mincha umaru. This paragraph of Shulchan Aruch is an explicit rebuke to all those anashim, which could be men, could be people. I presume Mishneh Berurah here means men, who are in a city and are too lazy to go to synagogue to pray mincha and marav. Now, it's interesting because he just said, you don't need to go there from marav. But mincha happens in the daytime still, so maybe that's what he means, right? But that makes clear that in the late 19th, early 20th century, probably not unlike other times in Jewish history, certainly not unlike our current moment, there are a lot of people who aren't going to minyan regularly, and they should. Okay, I also forgot to say in my review that one of the phrases we have to have is really about obligation to daven with a minyan are the three questions, right? Is there an obligation? To the extent there is an obligation, why? And what we've seen so far is either because it will make your davening better or because we want to make sure that there is a minyan, even though we don't actually care about you individually going. And then the third question is, and once we think about what, if there's an obligation and why, should those reasons be gendered? So here, what are we seeing mostly? We're mostly seeing a notion of either it will make your prayer better or it will ensure that there is a minyan. If it's the former, then anyone who's obligated to daven is obligated to daven with a minyan. And if it's the latter, then anyone who counts in the minyan is obligated to daven with a minyan. And we'll see in a couple of weeks how we think about who's obligated, who actually counts in the minyan. So the Aruch HaShulchan, a same time period basically as the Mishnah Berurah, also says a similar thing, that if you're living in a place where there's a synagogue, you have to go there to daven. But he actually adds something that I think is useful here, and the fact, right? The fact that we're not careful about this, right? I'm telling you that you're actually supposed to go to shul to daven with a minyan. It's not enough to daven at home. You really are, says the Aruch HaShulchan, following Rashi, obligated to daven with a minyan. Well, then why are people not careful about this? Why are so many people not going to minyan? Mishum she'anu holchem v'derech leparnas ha'seinu, right? It's because we travel often for work, right? And a lot of people, you know, for me, it's not work. It's actually 2 days a week. It's drop off at school. I'm in a carpool and I drop my kids off at school. And the timing of school is such that I cannot get to minyan if I'm going to drop my kids off at school. That actually doesn't quite work with his reasoning here, but I think it functions similarly, right? V'nechshav zeh ledavar mitzvah, right? Going to work is a mitzvah. Sharei mitzvah lefarnes ishto v'zaro. In a patriarchal society, as the rabbis understand it, a person, a man, is obligated to provide sustenance for his wife and his children. So if you have to go to work and you can't get to minyan as a result, then that's okay. It doesn't mean that you're not obligated to go to the minyan. It means that in that case, something overrides it. So all through, you get this idea that, like, yes, there's a desire to say this is an obligation, even though there aren't sources to that effect. And we understand that this is an obligation that's different from other kinds of obligations, right? It's not an obligation that's fully in your control. It's an obligation that is fundamentally about improving something rather than doing something. And it's an obligation that is dependent on others as well. The person who really takes this idea and blows it up into a full-fledged mitzvah, like you individually, I'm looking at the first two people on my screen as my examples, you, BM, and you, Yehudit, you both have an obligation to go to minyan every day, is Rav Moshe Feinstein, one of the most important, North American POSEC authority of the 20th century. And Rav Moshe is asked about a Talmud Chacham, a student in yeshiva, who stays up late to daven, to learn Torah. And because he stays up late, it's hard for him to wake up in time for minyan. And so he asks Rav Moshe, given that I'm staying up late to fulfill the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, can I be exempt from going to the minyan? Can I just sleep in, daven on my own, presumably a little bit faster than it would be with a minyan, and thereby save myself some time and get more learning in? We won't go through the whole tshuva, but Rav Moshe responds based on the Rashi in Psachim and the Shulchan Aruch that we just saw. No, you are obligated to go daven with a minyan. You cannot use your learning as an excuse to sleep in the morning and miss minyan. And he concludes, I think the conclusion here is the most interesting piece. You look at it on your own and see like all sorts of, he engages with all the texts that we've seen so far, or almost all of them. But I think, says Rav Moshe, ube'etzem, eiro esh yeshkan bitul Torah. Also, by the way, I've just gone through this whole thing and shown you why I think technically you're obligated to go to minyan, and therefore you may not use your learning late at night as an excuse not to go. But by the way, eiro esh yeshkan bitul Torah, I don't even understand what you're arguing about. Because you could arrange your learning so you won't lose out on communal prayer. That is to say, if I am staying up late to learn Torah, well, couldn't I just rearrange my day so that I'm learning just as much Torah or almost as much Torah and still daven with a minyan? Now, there's a little bit of slipperiness in Rav Moshe here, because the truth is, when I daven on my own, for better and for worse, it takes me less time than when I daven with a minyan, right? For worse, because I often daven with less kavana personally when I'm davening on my own, and so it goes faster. But also, there are things that I don't say when I'm, right, if it's Monday or Thursday, I don't do Torah reading, but if I were at shul, I would be davening Torah reading. I'd have to wait for all those sort of things that slow things down. And so I think what that gets across here is that you can understand why, for Rav Moshe and other authorities, and I imagine all the more so for communal rabbis, you have an incentive to say that you're obligated to daven with a minyan, right? You want people to go to minyan. And you're a little bit skeptical. Well, why aren't you, right? If you actually care about your prayer, then of course you should go to minyan. And I think this gets us back to this idea that fundamentally, to the extent that there is an obligation to daven with a minyan, it is about improving your prayer experience. To that extent, anyone who's obligated to daven is obligated to daven with a minyan. Let's pause here for questions or comments.
I'm sure this is too big of a question and maybe outside the parameters of this class, but it's interesting to me as somebody who I'm defined in my synagogue as the minyan cheerleader, because I do all sorts of things to try to ensure we have a small community that we have a twice a day daily minyan. So I'm always looking for reasons to encourage people to come to Minyan. So one of the things that I just wonder with all this is in learning about why, yes, Minyan, why we need a Minyan, why it's better than a Minyan. Why is it that we only have certain prayers that we can't say without a Minyan, whereas others that we can? Like, how did that differentiation come up? And how do we, I mean, in a non-Orthodox world, really saying Morris Kaddish is the only thing that really drives people. But there are other things as well. And I just wonder about that.
Yeah. So it's not too big a question. I'll say one little piece that I want to come back. We're going to come back to it in 2 weeks, actually. We start talking about Minyan proper. The one little piece I'll say is, like, I think it makes sense that we want to make sure that you have a prayer experience, even when you can't be in community, right? You know, you're traveling somewhere. It doesn't mean your connection to God has ceased just because you're not with community. And yes, you're obligated to pray 3 times a day with or without a community. And there are things that you can only do with a community. We'll see this more clearly in 2 weeks when we talk about Minyan, where it really, you know, to give real praise, well, in some sense, that's most valuable when people hear your praise. And so I think that's where this idea of the communal comes around. Also, just one more thing in terms of the motivation, right? I would say what we're seeing is two different motivations. And I've said this a couple of times, but I'm going to drill it in. One is, this is not true for everyone. It's true for me, but I know that there are two kinds of daveners. Those who daven with better kavana when they're davening with a minyan, that's me. And others who actually, honestly, I think daven better when they're not with a minyan. I feel bad for those folks, because if you think you're obligated to daven with a minyan, that's not great. But the other motivation is exactly what you're saying, Rina, that Morris Kaddish piece, not specifically in terms of Morris Kaddish, I would say, but in terms of generally having a minyan, there's a phenomenon that I think is probably less common than it used to be 50 years ago, of people who are not so observant that they're like, going to daven 3 times a day, or certainly not daven 3 times a day with a minyan, but they will always drive by their synagogue's parking lot at chakras time to see, are there 10 cars in the parking lot? And if there aren't, they'll pull in and they'll go. And if there are, they'll drive past and go to Dunkin' Donuts. Now, that's not my kind of Judaism. I want to be clear. Like, I think we're all obligated to daven 3 times a day. Probably not with a minyan, I don't think, but certainly not obligated to daven. But I really sort of respect that, even though it's not my Judaism. And I think it's sad that that sort of communal sense is failing a little bit. And I think we see that in some of these sources, right? That Tashbetz we saw, as long as there's a minyan without you, you may leave. But if you're leaving, will deprive the community of a minyan? Well, you have an obligation to the community to make sure that minyan is there.
So I had sort of a question and sort of an observation. It seems like the sources that we're looking at today are engaging a discussion about the role and context of communal prayer within participation in a broader observant Jewish society, when we daven, where we daven relative to when and where we're learning, and traveling. And it seems like there were sort of two leniencies suggested here, one of which was actually a rebuke. Men are exempted because they're lazy, I think is what it said. And the other was there's a leniency that comes along with fulfilling your obligation to provide sustenance for your wife and children. That leniency seems thematically related to the argument that you covered in the first week that purports a reason for why women are not obligated because they're raising children. So it seems like there's some understanding or balance in the relationship between communal tefillah and being with our families. I still don't really see anything in any of these sources so far today, which a priori says men have to do this and women do not.
Correct. So that last piece is the most important. If everything else is confusing to you, as long as you understand the last thing Jacob said, that's right on, Jacob. We've seen nothing here that would gender an obligation. And not only have we seen nothing, it's not just an argument from silence. All the things that we have seen would say either women are obligated because they're obligated in davening, or we don't know yet if women are obligated because it depends on do they count in a minyan, which we'll talk about in 2 weeks. Spoiler alert, I think they do, but we'll get there. In terms of the leniency, you know, I think the laziness piece, that's not a leniency, that's an accusation, right? God save us that we live in such a lazy community that people aren't going to minyan. I can say that because I'm one of those. I wouldn't say lazy, but my life is not set up. I need to work. I want to be clear, right? I need to be better about going to Minyan. Maybe if I believed that I had an actual obligation to go to Minyan, not maybe, definitely, I would go to Minyan more often than I do. So I can see why it's valuable to say there's an obligation, because I myself would benefit from saying that. And, you know, doesn't seem like these sources really are being clear about that.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, just maybe to get a little bit more into the weeds, I was curious, these contemporary sources that you're saying say that there's an individual obligation in minion attendance. So sort of on what grounds do they say that exists? Because obviously there are going to be practical ramifications to which reason you say they're obligated in minion. If it's just because that's how the best way to pray, then anyone who's obligated in prayer, versus if it's so that there's a you're individually obligated so that there's a minion, then only people who are minion eligible would have that obligation. So do they sort of go into those details?
So Rav Moshe does not, right? You know, I think his language kind of implies, and not language that I've left out. I think language that what you have here implies that it's about your davening being better when you're with a minion, but he doesn't state that. All he does is say, the Gemara in Pesachim says you got to go up to four meals to find a minion, or one meal backwards. The Gemara says something that's unclear, which Rashi interprets to mean what I just said. And therefore, it sounds like there's an obligation to daven with a minion, and therefore you lazy bum who wants to stay up late learning Torah, but not wake up to support your community in having a minion, you know, you can't get out of this, as Rav Moshe. So he doesn't give clear language for it. The next source, which is actually an earlier source, it's out of chronological order. I was trying to keep the sources organized by theme and focus. The next source will give us some reasoning. And to go back to what Jacob was just asking about, it will also be the first source that really genders this obligation in davening with a minion. All right, so that's all one line of thought. Either there is a very strong but not legally binding commitment to davening with a minion, or there is a commitment to davening with a minion, but we've seen nothing that would suggest that it is gendered. Going to go back a couple centuries now to the 1700s, Rav Yaakov Reischer, an important authority from, I believe, Bohemia, if I'm remembering correctly. And this is, as far as I know, the earliest source to say clearly there is an obligation to daven with a minion, and it is gendered. And you will see there's a very specific context here. So source number 14, Nishalti miyishuv echad. I was asked from a certain settlement, Shebal bayis echad yesh lo cheder besoch beiso, v'hiniach likanes hatzibur besoch hacheder anashim lochud v'nashim lochud bispalel. A guy has a house and he runs a shtibel in his basement, let's say, and separate sections for men and for women. V'achshav nolad ketata gedola bein balei batim bein balei bayis im echad min anashim v'isha shirgil levog lebeisik nesis. And now there's a big fight between this homeowner who lets people use his home as a shtiebel and one man and his wife. The homeowner, the shtiebel owner, says, Reuven and Rachel, I'm mad at you. You may not come to my house anymore to daven. Ufesakti, shelo yuchal esor mesveka, al achad minakal lisapech minachalas Hashem. And I ruled that this mistake is a little bit unclear, but it seems like I ruled that it's not totally clear, but to be on the safe side, he may not forbid this person from coming into his house. Aval al ishto hamaschalas tamid b'meriva, but for his wife, who's always starting the fights. Now, that's an interesting detail, right? I have no idea this is accurate. I have no idea this is misogyny of like, oh, women are fighting, like they're the ones who are argumentative, or if it's descriptive, like actually, yes, this particular woman was in fact the bigger problem. But let's notice that that's already the sort of assumption that the Shvut Yaakov has here, that the wife is the bigger problem. Regarding her, he may forbid her from coming to Shul. He may not forbid the husband, but he may forbid the wife. Why? Because even though she's obligated to daven, right? Notice he's going to contradict himself a little bit, but right, he starts out with the correct, like straightforward reading of all the sources. Even the woman's obligated to daven, just like a man, as explained in the Shulchan Aruch. Mikol makom, kevan she'isha eina mitzuva klal lispalel be'asara. However, since a woman is not obligated to daven with 10, she's obligated to daven, says the Shus Yaakov, but not with a minion. The eina misteref is the minion, below the kedusha klal, and she doesn't count for the minion. Kedamrinan isha be'azara minayin, as we say. Now, this is a strange thing from the site. He says one phrase from the Gemara, a woman in the temple courtyard, why would she ever be there? That's a very, I'm not going to go into the details of time of what's going on in that Gemara, but suffice to say the commentators have a big problem with that Gemara because in fact we know that there were women in the temple courtyard. There were times when women were obligated to go. For example, a woman who's accused of adultery would be in the temple courtyard. So it's a weird statement. He can't be using it technically, because technically it makes no sense here. He's using it rhetorically, right? In other words, women in public space, where does that come from? We don't have that. That's not a thing we normally do. Viv, Besula, Silanis, Mivale Olam, a young woman who literally, well, it's like a davening young woman, but it's generally understood as a woman who prays excessively, who screams out her prayers, destroys the world, which is another, again, I'm not going to go into the context for the sake of time, but another sort of rhetorical move rather than a sort of technical move, right? So Ukvarka's, what is he saying? He may forbid the woman from coming because even though she's obligated to daven, she's not obligated to daven with 10. And we sort of see this, he says, from these unrelated rhetorical statements, sort of either questioning women in public space or questioning women who are too publicly davening. And then he says, Ukvar kasav Magen Avraham. The Magen Avraham is already written. And I ellipsis this out because this is the Magen Avraham from 2 weeks ago, where comes up with that far-fetched argument to defend why women aren't davening. So he says, even the women are obligated to daven, they're not obligated to daven with 10, and they don't count towards the minyan, right? And I don't think those two things are unrelated, right? I think for the Shmuz Yaakov, right, the reason why women aren't obligated to daven with a minyan is because they don't count in a minyan, right? If I don't count, then I don't have value in making sure there is a minyan. It would seem like, again, I'm reading it, this is not explicit in the Shmuz Yaakov, but I think what he's implying is that the reason for the obligation is to make sure that there's a minyan. Women don't count towards the minyan, therefore they don't have that obligation. And by the way, even though I fundamentally they're obligated to daven, the Magen Avraham did give us an out, a limud zechus, to say, well, maybe they don't have to daven. So for all of that, lachen nira li deyachol limchos biyada achi faisu bimchol zeh lezeh, right? Therefore, he can stop her from coming to his house to daven with a minyan until make peace with each other. And this next part, I did not include simply to say, oh, look at what a misogynist he is, but I included because I think it's actually important for understanding where he's coming from. Because women tend to start fights. They are more likely to fight. Now, again, it doesn't matter if that's true. It's not. What matters is that this is the mindset the Shmuz Yaakov is in, either because it happened to be the case in this particular situation that he was asked about, or because that's just how he thinks about the world, right? Unfortunately. But that is a really important thing to keep in mind when we think about this is the source, the earliest source, to say there's an obligation to daven with a minyan and women don't have it. To the extent that he's clear about his reasoning, it has mostly to do with the fact that women don't count in a minyan, according to him. More on that in 2 weeks. But this is that core source.
Yeah, there's two things that I'm noticing. One is that women went to shul at those times. I mean, they went to daven publicly at that time because it didn't seem unusual that this woman came with her husband to daven. Another thing is that ruling does not detract from the fact that it's still better to daven in a minyan, even for women.
Yeah, I love both those points. On the first one, I will say, you know, we've talked about this before, right? There are definitely times in history where women are at least not davening with a minyan and maybe not davening at all, right? Magen Avraham's moment seems to be one of those moments when women aren't davening regularly. And we should not assume that that's always been the case, right? Davening history is not linear. And it seems like this woman in question is not the only woman going, right? There's a woman section in the first place. Unlike nowadays, when in many synagogues, they don't open a women's section during the week, right? At least here, they actually have a women's section. So yes, an important point also, like even as the Shmuz Yaakov is trying to shut down this idea of obligation to daven with a minyan for women, he's sort of acknowledging, well, but there are actually a lot of women, or at least some women in my community davening with a minyan. Let's go back into the sources to see some other alternative voices along these lines, not along these lines, some alternative voices. Okay. So two more sources on tefillah with a minyan. Rav Eliyahu Ragoler, the Yad Eliyahu. I apologize. I'm blanking on if he's 1800s or 18th century or 19th century. I think he's 19th century, but I don't remember. I'll look it up after class and I can let you guys know next week, or you can just Google him also. So this is, I love this source. It's a little complicated. So stick with me because it's really fascinating. Okay. Shaila, here's the question. Im yesh ve'ez the beis ha-knesses a-katan, o minyan, shal shisha o shiva anashim, shlo hispalalu, u shloshe hispalalu. So you're not in like some big grand cathedral synagogue. You're in a shul or a minyan where they barely get a minyan. And on this particular day, they have six or seven men who've not yet davened, and three men who have already davened. So the background here is that you're allowed to say things that require a minyan, as long as you have a minyan, six of whom have not yet davened, right? If only five are davening, it doesn't count as a minyan. But if six or more are davening, even if some of them already have davened, that still counts as a minyan. That's a very commonly relevant question to know about. So that's the background. I've got a minyan. I've got 10 men, right, in his framework. But only seven of them are davening, and three of them are just helping their friends out. They already davened, let's say. And in such a case, the only thing that that minyan allows you to do, the only thing, it's going to sound like this is everything, right? What does it allow you to do? In such a case, you can say Kaddish and Kedusha and Barhu, all these things that we call Tvarim Shabik Dusha, which we'll be talking about much more next week. So that's what this allows you to do. Aval, Ein ze ole le tefila betzibur. But this does not count as tefila betzibur, as communal prayer. Ki im ba'asara mamish. Unless you have 10 for real, 10 mamish. I don't even know how to translate that. 10 people who are actually davening. Now notice what the Yad Eliyahu is doing here. He's pointing out something that I think is almost certainly correct in terms of earlier sources, although some seem to go a different way on this. But he is distinguishing tefila betzibur, communal prayer, is not about saying Kedusha Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's its own thing. Communal prayer is that moment when you stand in community and you say the Amidah in a whisper alongside nine or more other adult halachic Jews who are also saying the Amidah in a whisper. That's tefila betzibur, and that is its own value. So to extend there's an obligation to daven with a minyan, says the Yad Eliyahu, that obligation is not to hear Kedusha, right? What does that even mean, hear slash say Kedusha? We'll talk about this more in 2 weeks, but it's actually not at all clear what it would mean to have an obligation in and to fulfill an obligation in Kedusha. The obligation is to daven the Amidah with nine or more other adult halachic Jews. So in this case, you don't have that because only seven of the Jews are davening, only some of the Jewish men are davening. Achen, however, nistapek li lichora, im yesh babayis hazeh shalosh nashim shemitpalalim, im yesh litzaref hanashim imahem, im nechsheves tefilas hanashim bichlal tzibur. But let's say I've got 13 adult halakhic Jews in the room, 10 of whom are men, 3 of whom are women, the 3 women are all davening, 7 of the men are davening. So I can say Kadosh Kedusha and Baruch Hu from his point of view, because I've got 10 adult halakhic Jewish men, and I've got tefila betzibur, perhaps. That's the question, is do I? Because I've got 7 adult halakhic Jewish men davening, plus 3 adult halakhic Jewish women davening. Maybe those 7 and 3 combine make tefila betzibur. V'nira lifshot mehad ve'amar, and it seems to me like we can resolve it from that which is said. He's quoting the Gemara that we saw last week. Tisha ve'eved mistarfin. We didn't see this part of it. We'll see the next part. 9 adult halakhic Jews and 1 non-Jewish slave owned by a Jew, mitzarfin, they combine to make a minyan. As always, I'm going to note the problematic nature of talking about owning slaves, but we're not going to focus on it. And they objected in that Gemara. We saw this last week. Wait a minute. Rabbi Eliezer freed his slave in order to make a minyan. Well, that makes it seem like slaves don't count in a minyan, even as the 10th member. Umetaret, and they resolve there in the Gemara, Trey have chaser. Oh, why did Rabbi Eliezer need to free his slave to make the minyan? Because they actually only had 8 adult halachic Jews. And so he freed one slave and counted the other slave as the 10th toward the minyan. That's what the Gemara said. Vahashta. And now, right? E amra to tefilas nashim einam bichlal tefilas et sibor. If you say that women's prayer does not count towards the minyan for tefila but sibor, for davening with 9 other Jews, Kmo delo mistarfen osam lekadosh v'kedusha, just like they don't count for kadosh and kedusha, we're going to trouble that notion in 2 weeks. But from his point of view, women don't count towards the minyan to say kadosh and kedusha. So if you were to say that they also don't count for tefila betzibur, imken habalei leTalmud leShanuye delachen shechar avdo bichtei lizbalal betzibur. And you could have said, oh, why did he free a slave not to say kadosh and kedusha? Because they only count as a tenth for that. But in order to feel a bit Sibor, he would need to free his slave to make him an adult halachic Jew, right? They didn't say that, right? And we know, I'm not going to read this inside because it's going to get too complicated. You can look at it on your own if you want. We know this is a problematic statement, even though it makes sense in its context, but I'm just noting that. We know that halachically, adult Jewish women and non-Jewish slaves owned by Jews, God forbid, in a world where they have slavery, we know that they are halakhically identical to their obligations. And so if a woman's prayer counted for as the minyan for tefillah bet sibur, for communal prayer, then this slave's prayer would have counted for that. If we knew that a woman's prayer didn't count, then the slave's prayer wouldn't count. The Talmud should have said, oh, we freed the slave in order to have prayer with a minyan. It didn't say that. Therefore, it must be that that slave's prayer does count towards tefillah bet sibur, and therefore women's prayers also count. And therefore, says the Yad Eliyahu, if I'm davening in a minyan with 13 people, three of whom are 13 adult halachic Jews, three of whom are women, three of whom are men who aren't davening, well, I've got tefillah bet sibur. Not because of the 10 men, but because of the 7 davening men and the 3 davening women. Gustav, I might share, say one more thing and then take questions, because I know that this is a technical bit here, which is to say, this is important not only conceptually to think about, well, what is tefillah bet sibur and how does gender play into it? Tefillah bet sibur is davening with other Jews, and women for the Yad Eliyahu definitely count toward that. It's also, for those of you who daven in non-egalitarian minyanim, very important practically. Back when I daven more regularly in non-egalitarian minyanim, we would often run into the problem of how do we encourage folks to come to minyan in a way that doesn't only encourage men and not women, right? If you're only counting men toward the minyan, then it makes women in that community feel like their presence isn't valued. We can talk about when we get to minyan, you know, why that might be, and different folks in this room might feel differently about that. But it's also worth saying, even in a non-egalitarian context, the Yad Eliyahu is reminding us that the prayer of women actually is significant. Even if you're in a community that doesn't count women toward the minyan, it's still communally significant for this value of tefillah bet sibur. Okay.
So if we buy the Yad Eliyahu like for real, then we've somehow created both a chiyuv for tefillah bet sibur and a separate minyan chiyuv for dvarim shebekedusha. And like where are we pulling that out of?
Fantastic. So one thing that I'm going to want to make clear 2 weeks from now is that this whole discourse that has been the dominant discourse for the last 50 years of, oh, you only count in a minyan if you are chayiv to daven or to daven with a minyan or to be in a minyan, right? Whatever it is, that there's like this one-to-one thing that somehow is the determining factor, does not hold up, right? And the way you know that is Rashi clearly thought women had an obligation to daven. And I don't think, even though he doesn't talk about it, I don't think he thought women counted a minyan, right? So that idea, we're going to have to think from the ground up, well, what does it mean to count in a minyan? Why would someone count or not count in a minyan? And we should get rid of our preconceived notions that it has to do with one-to-one obligation. Because clearly, Yad Eliyahu thinks when we're obligated to pray, they're obligated to pray with a minyan, and therefore their prayers count towards prayer in a minyan. But that doesn't mean they help constitute a minyan for purposes of Kaddish, Kedusha, and Baruch Hu. Did that answer your question, Hannah?
Not quite. My question is, like, where did we get this division of there's both a chiyuv to like be in a minyan, and that's separate from whether or not you count for Kaddish, right, Kedusha, and Baruch Hu?
Ah, good. So where did the Eliyahu get it from? To some extent, I think he makes it up, right? To some extent. Now, he doesn't make it out of whole cloth, right? Because there clearly is this idea that you are supposed to daven, and we see all these things about ideally you should daven at, you know, with asara, and it doesn't say you should daven in order to say kedusha. So I think he's getting it out of the fact that like it makes sense to him, right? He's not just making it up for some purpose, right? He's making it up because that's how he sort of understands the obligation of prayer. But I don't think there's a clear source before him that would say you're obligated to hear kedusha and you're obligated to daven with a minyan. Those are two different chiyuvim. In part because until the modern period, early modern period, I don't think we see anyone who thinks there's an obligation in any of these things, right? These are things that we do, not things that we're obligated in. So I think that's part of the challenge here, is like the whole discourse of obligation in minyan is fundamentally an early modern and modern discourse.
I don't really understand Skamar, because he had freed one and counts the other. Why would he have to free if the obligation is the same? Then why does he have to free either one of them? Then he either counts, right, them both, or it, then and the status is this. And if that's a status the same as a woman, then he counts them both. Why does he have to free one,
right,
and count the other? I don't. It's not making sense to me. That or makes, okay, I don't understand how this ties out to our, right, conclusion.
I'm I'm going to give it one more shot to try to explain what the Yad Eliyahu is saying here. It is confusing. If you don't get it, unfortunately, today I have to run out right at 2, so I can't stick around for some extra time. But next week, God willing, after class, we can come back to it if this doesn't work. But let me say it one more time, because I suspect you're not the only one who's still confused about it. In the Gemara, Rabbi Eliezer's a situation. So you're in a room with 9 adult halakhic Jews and one, at least initially we think, Gentile slave. Oh, so Eliezer frees his slave. They say, wait a minute, why do you do that? Then you tell me that 9 adult Jews plus an Eved constitute a minion. Oh, what does the Gemara say? There were actually only 8 adult halakhic Jews there and 2 Avadim. And so he freed one and counted the other one. That's the Gemara, and that is somewhat straightforward. Maybe far-fetched, but somewhat straightforward. The Yad Eliyahu says, if the prayers of women and slaves did not count towards communal prayer, then what the Gemara should have said is not, oh, there were 2 people missing, so we had to free one and count one. What it should have said is, oh, the slave counts towards Kedusha and Kajan Baruch Hu, but they don't count towards Tefillah B'Tzibur, and so that's why he freed the Eved. The Gemara did not say that, and therefore it must be that the prayers of Avadim and women indeed do count towards Tefillah B'Tzibur. That's why the Gemara couldn't say that, because in fact they had Tefillah B'Tzibur even with the Eved unfreed.
But couldn't he just count 8 and 2 slaves?
No, because what the Gemara says is you can only, we'll see this when we get to Minyan in 2 weeks, actually in 3 weeks, I think. There are a whole host of cases where that the 10th spot in a Minyan we're willing to take more leniency on. If you've ever been in a synagogue that says, oh, we'll count 9 in the Torah scroll, that is a misinterpretation. That is actually not well-based in halakhic sources, but it is a misinterpretation of a real source. So we'll get there, but there's a little more room to play with the 10th than with the 8th.
So I'm seeing the Yad Eliyahu sort of talking about 2 different types of minyanim that kind of overlap in sort of a Venn diagram. There's like the minyan for Tefillah B'Tzibur and a minyan for Dvarim Shebikdusha, which are, so people who, men who are not praying count for the Dvarim Shebikdusha minyan, and women who are praying count for the Tefillah B'Tzibur minyans. And he says specifically Kedusha, Kaddish, and Baruch Hu, but does that mean for the repetition of the Amidah that goes with the Tefillah B'Tzibur prayer, and that you can only have, like, if it's 7 men and 3 who are praying, 3 men who aren't praying, would he say that, and no one else there, would he say that you don't have a repetition? And if you add 3 men, you would have a repetition, even though you could say Kaddish?
Yeah. I mean, logically, it feels like he should be saying that actually, since the Kever Tefillah B'Tzibur, you would still say the Chazaras HaShatz. Now, the problem with that is we say, it's a little bit fuzzy, right? Do we repeat the Amidah so as to fulfill everyone's obligation who might not have been able to say the Amidah on their own? We'll talk a lot more about that in a couple of weeks when we get to Minyan. Or do we repeat the Amidah in order to say Kedusha? If it's the latter, then the fact that they don't count for its Kedusha would mean you still wouldn't be able to say Chazaras HaShatz with a Minyan of 7 men and 3 women. If it's because of fulfilling people's obligations, then he doesn't say this. And I wish he did. I wish he actually were a little more explicit here. But you could at least imagine an argument and say, like, okay, so right, I can imagine a half egel minion that would say women count towards Chazaras HaShatz without Kedusha, but not towards Kaddish Kedusha and Baruch Hu. I can imagine pulling that out of the Yad Eliyahu. I don't think the Yad Eliyahu would say that, but I don't know because he doesn't address it. Great. Let's jump back in and finish off these sources. Actually, just one more source. And this is a 20th century source, Rav Yaakov Ariel, whom I forgot to check. I believe he is still alive, what did I just do? Last I checked a couple years ago, Rav Ariel was still alive. He was the chief rabbi of Ramat Gan, but he's a 20th and 21st century authority, the chief rabbi of Ramat Gan. He is in many ways a very interesting, sort of out of the box halakhic thinker. And the question that he is asked here is, a woman gets to shul late on Shabbos, and she gets there basically in time for Musaf, but she has not yet davened Shacharis. And so she wants to know, should she daven Musaf first and daven out of order, so she's davening with the community, davening Tefillah B'Tzibur, or should she daven Shacharis first? And if she's davening Shacharis at the same time as they're davening Musaf, does that count as Tefillah B'Tzibur? She's davening at the same time as everyone else, but she's davening a different immediate from what they're davening, and so on and so forth. That's the core question. We're not seeing the whole tshuva, which is a piece that's relevant to our question. Says Rav Yaakov Ariel, "V'im ki isha chayeves b'tfilas hamusaf, acha sheilahi imi chayeves lispel b'tzibor davka." And even though I've just shown you that a woman is obligated to daven musaf, nonetheless, there's a question, is she obligated to daven with a minyan? Or maybe her only obligation is daven on her own, in which case, unambiguously, she should do chakras first and not worry about davening musaf with the community. Mihu, nira shegam isha chayim es lispil av esibor. It seems that a woman also is obligated to daven with a minyan, just like a man. Shneamar, hein kel kabir velo yimas. This is the verse we saw last week, brought in the Gemara as one of the proofs that a person should always strive to have with a minion. God, the pshat of this is God is mighty but not contemptuous. But the midrashic reading here is not hein kel kabir velo yimas. God is mighty but not contemptuous. Rather, hein kel kabir lo yimas. God will not reject the prayers of the many. Right, being kabir not as mighty but as many. And so his advice to her is actually, yes, you should daven musaf with the community, because you're obligated to daven, not just to daven, but to daven with the community. So say musaf now when everyone else is davening, and then you should say davening, and then you say shacharis afterwards. So this is by far the clearest, even clearer than the Yad Eliyahu, a straightforward statement that in fact women are obligated to daven, not only to daven, but to daven with a minyan. Why? Because the obligation of davening with a minyan comes out of a desire that your davening be as meaningful and valuable as possible. Okay, we've got 5 minutes left. I don't think it's enough time to start the next source sheet. So we're just going to pick up the next source sheet next week. So that means 5 minutes. Let's start with questions or comments on this, but hopefully we'll also have some time to, if there are broader questions that come up over the first 3 weeks, to check in about those as well. So questions or comments on the Yad Eliyahu or the Rav Yaakov Ariel. I've got Randy with one. And anyone else? Go for it, Randy. No, but you're muted, Randy.
This question is sort of general. I wanted to ask it, in the beginning of the class. Does this take into account how much literacy there was over all these centuries? I mean, did women... They say women are davening, but can they even read?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to remember that for a lot of this time period, and it depends on where we're talking about, how much of this time period, it's actually not about literacy. It's about education, which is different. Because
right. In
a lot of communities, it's not as if everyone has a sitter. And so it may be more about, like, have you been taught to daven? I think it is the case that in many communities, women would have been taught to daven. As we've seen, many of these sources, like most of these sources, say they're obligated. And so presumably they would still be educating women in davening, even if they're not educating them in learning Chumash or certainly not rabbinics.
But before the printing press, I mean, where did all these people have siddurim from?
They didn't, right? I mean, most of them would not. But like, you know, my kids, it's kind of amazing to me. You know, my older two kids are 14 and 12. And I'm constantly like questioning, they'll daven without a sitter. And I'll be like, are you really saying all the words? But they are, because they, from a young age, went to a school where they're doing a lot of the davening out loud. And so actually it's easier for them to daven by memory than it is to daven out of a sitter. Like their memory is actually stronger than their reading ability, I would say. Whatever, they have good reading ability too. I don't want to cast aspersions on their reading in public. But so I think it's not unreasonable. And in earlier time periods, people had better memories. This has been documented that the rise of the printing press has actually made our memories much worse than they used to be. Anthropologists have shown if you go to communities that are relatively unaffected by the printing press, they're actually able to engage in amazing works of memory that we've kind of lost because we've become so reliant on books. So I think that, you know, certainly people would have been davening from memory. But the other piece of this, which we'll get into in 2 or 3 weeks when we can talk about minyan, is one of the arguments, I mentioned this earlier in response to Andrew's question, one of the arguments for why do we have the repetition of the Amidah, the Chazar Sashats, is precisely because there weren't siddurim for everyone and not everyone had that education. Not everyone was learned the davening from heart. And so what would you do? You would stand at attention and you would answer amen to every blessing of the Amidah that the chazan said out loud. And that would help you fulfill your obligation, right? That's at least in one telling of the story, why we have the reader's repetition of the Amidah. So that's the other way. And in that scenario, you certainly have to go to minyan in order to fulfill your obligation to pray.
I think your answer is going to be that we're going to address this in 2 or 3 weeks when we talk about minyan. But I'm just wondering, in terms of Tefillah B'Tzibur versus Devarim Shebekedusha, which is the higher level, more important, more stringent? Which one's better?
Yeah, I don't think, I don't know of a source that gets into that in a straightforward way. There'll be sources we see in 2 weeks. It, my answer is actually not for the most part. We'll talk about it in 3 weeks. For the most part, we won't. I don't think the sources really get into it. But some of the sources that we will see in 2 weeks will hint at, not that Kedusha is better than Davening with a Minyan, but that there's something very special about Kedusha. There's something unique about it. Even more so than Kaddish and Baruch Hu, I would say. It's a source I love, which is why I'm already sort of giving you a foreshadowing of that source. So we'll see that in 2 weeks, God willing. So just to summarize where we are and where we're about to go, we spent the first 3 weeks. I see that someone asked that Rabbi Yaakov Ariel is the same. He's the chief rabbi, was or is the chief rabbi of Ramat Gan. I actually, like I said, I forgot to check to see if he's still alive. He's old, so it's possible that he's no longer still alive. But last I checked, he was. Yeah, so what we've seen so far is obligation in davening does not seem to be a reason to distinguish between women and men, folks of all genders, with regard to communal prayer life. Where we're about to go in the next 3 weeks is really the heart of this class, which is with that sort of red herring put to the side, right? Get rid of this argument that you'll often hear made, women aren't obligated to daven or aren't obligated to daven with a minyan, that's why they don't count. That we've seen is a terrible argument, because at best, those are minority post-facto justifications and not sort of core principled expressions of what halacha wants of us. With that put to the side, we'll begin asking next week, so what does it mean to read from the Torah in public? What does it mean in 2 weeks to lead davening, to say Kaddish, Kedusha, and Baruch Hu for the community? And what does it mean in 3 and 4 weeks, I think those are the right numbers, to daven with the minyan and count in a minyan? What does it mean to actually be counted toward the minyan? That's where we're going now that we've set aside this canard of that there's some idea of a gender gap in obligation.